Father John Hardin's following conference is entitled How to Train the Sexual Instinct. Father Hardin.
I think the subject is important enough to spend as much time as we can muster because of its practical value in the spiritual life in general and religious life in particular. The value of going through a brief analysis of the meaning of the sexual instinct is because people commonly associate it with only one kind of urge or desire. There are four levels to that instinct. Let me first give a general description. The sexual instinct is the natural urge to venereal pleasure, the procreation of children, family life, and lifelong companionship with a person of the opposite sex. So the sexual instinct is the natural urge to venereal pleasure, comma, the procreation of children, family life, and lifelong companionship with a person of the opposite sex. You see immediately that the sexual instinct is natural, hence it is an instinct. An instinct is a natural tendency of our powers or faculties to seek the object of the desire or the urge. There are four basic elements to this sexual instinct. The first is to venereal experience. The second is to the begetting of offspring. The third is to living in a family. And the fourth is to a lifetime companionship with a person of the opposite sex, a man or woman, as the case may be. I think it is of more than passing value to note that there are four and not just one element to that instinct. The venereal experience is only one part. And for a lot of people, when they hear the word sex or sexual, it is about the only thing they think of. And I dare say, for most people, it is the principal drive or desire. But as we enter to the analysis of training the sexual instinct in the religious life, we must take stock of all four elements and not just one. So much for the meaning. We ask ourselves, what is the universal need for training this instinct? In other words, everyone needs to be trained in the proper use or response to this drive or instinct. This is well to know. Otherwise, in the training of people in the religious life, we are liable to overlook the prior and more fundamental need for training. We will look at both the universal need and the distinctive need, universal for all human beings and distinctive for religious. What is the basic reason for the universal need to train the sexual instinct so that everyone, parents tell me, and I wouldn't have to have them tell me, but they tell me that a child from infancy must be trained in the proper response to the sexual drive. And that's years before puberty or adolescence. The fundamental reason why everyone needs to have this instinct trained is concupiscence. As we know, concupiscence is the consequence of the fall of our human nature, as a result of which we lost our gift of integrity. Now, while concupiscence affects all seven basic drives of human nature, both spiritual and bodily, our whole nature is fallen. We are naturally prone to pride, naturally prone to greed, naturally prone to sloth, and so are the others. Nevertheless, and this says something, in common parlance, the moment the word concupiscence is used, the first thought is the loss of our integrity as regarding the passion to lust. Concupiscence is commonly and correctly associated, though it should never be exclusively identified, with the venereal or the sexual instinct. We have seven drives of our fallen human nature, only one of which is the sexual or venereal drive. I would like to be as clear as I could, because in the training of people, including ourselves and those under our care, in the mastery of the sexual desires, it is well to know that there are four levels of this concupiscence, or of our fallen human nature, each one of which must be trained, corresponding to the four elements that constitute the sexual instinct. Let me rename the four parts of the instincts, and then point out briefly how, because of our fallen human nature, we lack a built-in control on each of these four levels. First, regarding venereal pleasure. Because we have concupiscence, we have a natural tendency to seek this pleasure of and for itself, apart from marriage and the divinely instituted purpose of matrimony. So what is fallen about our human nature as regards venereal pleasure? It is to seek that pleasure independent of its legitimate use or experience in matrimony. Secondly, given the venereal pleasure, there is a divinely ordained purpose that children be conceived and born as the fruit of that pleasure. And one reason that God gives the intense pleasure from sexual experience is to both lighten the burdens of nurturing children and the responsibility which this involves. There is, if you wish, a divinely given compensation. What then is the fallen human nature's tendency? It is to have the pleasure apart from children, In other words, to practice contraception and abortion. So that even between married people, their sexual instinct must be controlled. They may legitimately enjoy venereal pleasure. They may not enjoy that pleasure apart from the intention of rearing children. Contraception and abortion are simply fallen human nature manifesting itself in the desire for venereal experience without the burden of offspring. Thirdly, our fallen human nature renders the third element, which is the object of sexual instinct, namely family life. What is the consequence of having a fallen human nature on this level? It is to experience the enjoyment of social living, but without the burdens of a family. In other words, to have all kinds of groups, societies, associations, you name it. We are naturally social beings, but the primary object of social living on the natural level and apart from the fall of man is a family. A gang is a substitute for a family. And that's why so much in our modern society, all sorts of communitarian living, but apart from a family. Until social scientists, especially from outside of our country, are saying that if the United States continues the way it's going, family will disappear. And fourth, one of the objects of the sexual instinct, as we saw earlier, is or should be a lifelong companionship with a person of the opposite sex. Well, all sorts of companionship, scarcely lifelong, with persons of the opposite sex, but apart from marital responsibility. I may have mentioned on some occasion, a deacon that I had in class some time ago in New York told me that a judge friend of his in New York City, who had been on the bench for a number of years, 10 years ago, would average some 400 civil marriages that he would witness in his office as a judge, 400 in a given year. Last year, he told my deacon student, he had 10. Same place, if any of the population was higher, but they're just shacking up. Until now, the Lutheran School of Theology here in Chicago, on whose faculty I am still a member until the 1st of June, has in its last General Assembly officially approved, provided there is love between a man and a woman, to live together independent of marriage. Well, this is now the official teaching of the LCA, the Lutheran Church of America. God help the people. You wonder why they still call it a church. Now, Luther had some strange ideas about sexual experience, but that one he never had. So, that's the first reason why everyone needs training in the sexual instinct. I think it is important to stress this, lest we somehow feel that those who enter the religious life, well, are independent of the common lot of human nature. And just because a person lives, say, a long span of years, does not, with the passage of time, remove concupiscence. Concupiscence remains. But note what I wanted to bring out. Concupiscence, for our purpose, has four levels of aberration. It is not only the urge to have venereal experience. It is to not want children, to have the experience even in marriage, but without children. Or to have a companion, maybe a child or two, but avoid the burdens. When I walk my four blocks from St. Ignatius, where I live on Park Avenue, to the Lexington Avenue subway on 86th Street, I pass two large daycare centers. And more than once, especially, see around 8, 8:30 in the morning, around 5 in the evening, I can hardly pass the crowd on a very broad sidewalk because of the many children with their mothers either delivering their offspring to the daycare center or picking their offspring up. They just don't want the burden of family life. And though it'll take a few extra minutes, I think it's worth mentioning. I'm not sure whether anywhere in class I have told you about what's going on in Denmark relative to what we're speaking of here. Some time ago, I had occasion to give a lecture at Southern Illinois University. During dinner, the first evening I was there, one of the faculty members at table with me had been lecturing during the summers at the University of Copenhagen, a Protestant. I said, "Father, do you know what they're doing in Denmark?" Well, I had no idea except maybe eating Danish pastry. Ever tell you this? Well, he said, in Denmark, they now have legalized artificial insemination so that many women who want children but don't want the burden of a husband or a family go to a government agency, have a catalog of men, everything but the picture. Then they become artificially inseminated, and the government makes sure one insemination is enough. Then they go back to work. When the time for delivery comes, the government pays for everything, the child is delivered, and becomes a ward of the state. The woman, because she's mother of the child, has a right to take the child with her to her apartment 1 day a week, 2 days a month, 3 days a week, as often as she wants. The government rears the child completely this professor told me, I was shown a row of high-rise apartments in Copenhagen where I was told the only men on the premises are the janitors. That's what happens to the uncontrolled sexual instinct. There are people, you'll want companionship, say we'll have a child around at times whenever it suits their fancy, and men only as much and as often as they want, never unwanted pregnancy, and when even a pregnancy is undesired, abortion. I should add to close the story, because I may never have a chance to say it again, the same professor told me, just as the government has complete control of the conception, pregnancy, and birth of its citizens, so at the other end of the spectrum, Denmark has a new suicide law where suicide is a normal and legally permissible way of ending your life. You go to the suicide agency. They give it another name provided by the government. Plush apartments where you consult as to when it would be a good time for you to leave this world. Your personality is studied and you're told what kind of suicide would be the most agreeable, would best suit your temperament. You sign your will, and then you're provided a painless way of leaving this world. And that's going on today. Universal need for everyone to control the sexual drive. What's another reason for the universal need for sexual training? It is the inhuman social pressures to which people, especially in Western society, are exposed from infancy and all through life to enjoy the pleasures on these four levels that we've been saying, without obeying God's laws. The customs in a society like ours, where nudity is almost a way of life, the laws of our nation, encouraging at the one extreme pornography, at the other extreme, abortion, and the two should always be seen together. Once the sexual impulses are aroused, strongly and even deliberately stimulated, pregnancy is bound to occur in spite of all the efforts at sterilization and contraception, and then the only alternative is infanticide. The pressure of peer conformity. Social scientists say in a country like America, this is the first and strongest pressure on Americans to conform to the practices of their peers. And I'm told it starts from the age of 3 or 4. Children don't want to be different. the social pressure of economics, making it increasingly difficult to either enter marriage and even support, say, a wife, and much more so, a normal family. What's a normal family? It's no less than 2 children in the United States. And then, of course, the press and media. All of these are important because in the training of the sexual instinct of religious, they have come pretty well shaped by the social pressures before they enter. And no matter how isolated or insulated a community may be, even so, it is impossible to resist all of these pressures.
This concludes Father Hardin's lecture on the subject, How to Train the Sexual Instinct. In the following lecture, Father Hardin speaks on the subject, the distinctive need for the training of the sexual instinct in religious. Father Hardin.
The first general principle. Beyond all we've said, where every normal human being needs to be trained to control the sexual instinct, the first reason why the training of religious has to be more and different is because our consecrated chastity is not only temperance, but a life of sacrifice. In other words, the religious must be trained beyond temperance to sexual sacrifice. Another word for sexual temperance is chastity. Another word for sexual sacrifice is celibacy. That's not the same thing. The second presumes the first, but it goes beyond the first. One important caution. It is imperative that we find out whether those whom we accept have the grace to go beyond temperance to sacrifice. And one evidence that they don't have the grace is if they have not learned to practice sexual temperance. And because aberrations in this matter are the nature of things, not common or public knowledge, and people, especially women, very reticent to talk about it, to tell others. And remarkably, from years of experience in the priesthood, women are generally more reluctant to talk about their sexual experiences or past with a fellow woman than, say, with a man or a priest. This is good to know. There is a built-in reluctance in every human being to talk about this. There is an added reluctance when, as it has to be, the one who is doing the counseling or direction is of the same sex. But in general, there are exceptions. Men tend to be more ready to talk about these things than women. And yet, we are talking now about the distinctive need for the training of the sexual instinct of religious, going beyond the need for the training of the sexual instinct for every person, which we've spent about 40 minutes on. And I said, speaking in general, there are 2 principles that need to be kept in mind before we get into details, and this is one subject that I think is worth going into in detail because of its pervasive influence and the tragedies in religious life unless this is early controlled. The first general principle is that a religious, unlike other human beings, must be trained to go beyond sexual temperance to the practice of sexual sacrifice. The first thing you must find out, kindly, gently, patiently, but if you're going to train this person, you must find out whether they are capable of sexual sacrifice. I emphasize the imperative must because 20, 30 years after being in the religious life, what should have been known in the first month of postulancy, that this person is just not equipped for sexual sacrifice because he or she is not even capable, at least given the past record, of sexual temperance. In God's name, find yourself a good partner and get married. Don't rush it, but do it as soon as possible. The second general principle: the person must be seen to be capable of not only temporary sexual sacrifice, but a lifetime commitment to sexual sacrifice. There are many reasons why the church, especially in recent years, has extended the period of first formation from postulancy or even aspirancy on through final vows, 6, 7, even 9 years. I believe the single most important reason is to give the person the opportunity to prove to themselves and to those who have charge of them that they are capable of a lifetime commitment to sexual sacrifice. And lest I forget to mention this, that part of this training should also be living under varied conditions. Not, of course, situations that would be needlessly provocative. Nevertheless, they should not be merely and exclusively conditions in which the person is always, you might say, kept indoors, out of normal contact with other people, because engaging, for example, in the apostolate for an active community means dealing with others, including with people of the opposite sex. They better get evidence before they take their final vows that they are capable of dealing with people of the opposite sex quietly, calmly, prudently, and happily. Now, in particular, when we get down to the means, I have 12 means, each of which has a variety of subdivisions. I'm still on analyzing the distinctive need for sexual training for religious, because I believe no matter how detailed we will be about the means, it is important to first know how there was a distinctive need for religious, and common sense enlightened by faith and grace will tell us many things that we couldn't possibly bring up, wouldn't even have the time, as to how it's to be done. Be sure you know why it must be done, because the religious life is different from that of other human beings who must also train themselves in controlling the imperious sexual drive. On each of the four levels, remember, we analyze the sexual instinct as having four parts: venereal pleasure, which must be controlled; children, which must be controlled; family, which must be controlled; companionship, which must be controlled. What is the special need of religious as regards controlling sexual pleasure? The special need for religious is not only to control their venereal urge so as never to willfully and deliberately indulge the sexual appetite except within the precincts of marriage, but that they must, and whatever else I say, the next sentence I consider may be the heart of everything I'm going to say, they must be trained to live a happy, cheerful life, although they sacrifice the lifetime prospects of marriage. Let me repeat. They must be trained to live a happy, that's interior, cheerful, that's exterior, life, even though they have sacrificed for a lifetime the prospects of marriage. Whatever else you know about training religious in mastering their sexual drive, be sure you know this. One reason, the basic reason, for the power of that drive is the pleasure it gives. Religious must somehow compensate for that pleasure by living a life which is, in the full human sense, enjoyable. All I know, and how well I know, is that one of the first dangers to a religious who is, as the expression goes, not happy, one of the first things to be tried and tampered with is chastity. An unhappy religious has a hard time being a chaste religious.
Common sense says that that is so false, so founded. That's as though all married people are happy.
Well, that's, but I'm just saying,
yes. Uh-huh.
The urge is there. It's the easiest, simplest way. You don't even have to have anybody around you. And you can have intense physical pleasure. The very power of that drive, however, means, and although the language is that of psychology, the truth is that of faith. A religious on this first level must be trained to sublimate, which means to elevate the kind of joy or happiness or satisfaction. Happiness, and be sure to distinguish, is interior. Cheerfulness is happiness manifest. Both are necessary. So that's why there is a special need for religious. This is on level one of the four parts of the sexual instinct. Secondly, children. There is a natural, built-in desire for parenthood. Every normal man or woman has this desire. In fact, not to have it is not to be normal. Even as the level of pleasure must be elevated, so the level of parenthood must be elevated. Through grace, the religious must be trained to raise their natural desire for physical fatherhood or motherhood to the supernatural desire for spiritual parenthood. After the urge for self-preservation, man's history says the next strongest drive is for self-reproduction. The whole question is, what level of reproduction will that take and accept for Christ, who first practiced it, then taught it, and said for those who have the grace, it is possible. Listen, we would never dream of such a thing as spiritual parenthood. And this must be recognized, must be worked with. It is not a question, in the first case, to repeat myself. It is not a question of some Manichaean suppression of enjoyment. Nor is it some kind of Manichaean suppression of the desire for children. We produce ourselves supernaturally. Say through faith, we have the faith, others who don't yet have it, inherited, so to speak, from us. We speak of propagating the faith. But then, once the faith is propagated and the supernatural life is communicated, corresponding analogously to the propagation of the natural life, parenthood is bifocal. It is not only the begetting, but the rearing. So I would say then the superior, to sustain the analogy, has the role of rearing those who are under his or her spiritual care. Does that make sense?
Well, that's almost saying that I should have a desire to become a superior.
Brother, sure you can have a supernatural desire to be a superior. In other words, you couldn't have a community without superiors. Faith tells me without superiors there's no community. Therefore, there must be superiors. And naturally, I don't like to be, and I discovered in Chicago here when I worked with the provincial, the list, a confidential list of those who were said to be apti ad gubernandum, suitable for government, those who showed inclination, pardon me, who showed qualifications for being made superiors. And among that list, some were chosen. I discovered I was not on the list. I was very happy that I am not suited for government. Fine. But if the Lord would want me and I have the aptitude, I may not like it, naturally. Sure, I can desire it supernaturally.
The grace is such a wonderful thing that I know in my own life, to have the time for prayer and so forth. As we pray, certainly souls are being gotten for Christ all over the world through grace.
And I would say, for example, that a person who is, say, appointed superior may naturally be reluctant to hold the office, but I'd like to think the superiors supernaturally enjoy their office. I'd hate to be under a superior who detests being a superior.
Please turn over to side B and push the play button immediately without rewinding the tape.